The Illustrious Gaudissart. The Illustrious Gaudissart. Chapter 1. The commercial traveler, a personage unknown to antiquity, is one of the striking figures created by the manners and customs of our present epoch. May he not, in some conceivable order of things, be destined to mark for coming philosophers the great transition which welds a period of material enterprise to the period of intellectual strength? Our century will bind the realm of isolated power, abounding as it does in creative genius, to the realm of universal but leveling might, equalizing all products, spreading them broadcast among the masses, and being itself controlled by the principle of unity, the final expression of all societies. Do we not find the dead level of barbarism succeeding the saturnalia of popular thought in the last struggles of those civilizations which accumulated the treasures of the world in one direction? The commercial traveler. Is he not to the realm of ideas what our stagecoaches are to men and things? He is their vehicle, he sets them going, carries them along, rubs them up with one another. He takes from the luminous center a handful of light, and scatters it broadcast among the drowsy populations of the duller regions. This human pyrotechnic is a scholar without learning, a juggler hoaxed by himself, an unbelieving priest of mysteries and dogmas, which he expounds all the better for his want of faith. Curious being! He has seen everything, known everything, and is up in all the ways of the world. Soaked in the vices of Paris, he affects to be the fellow well-met of the provinces. He is the link which connects the village with the capital, though essentially he is neither Parisian nor provincial, he is a traveler. He sees nothing to the core, men and places he knows by their names, as for things, he looks merely at their surface, and he has his own little tape line with which to measure them. His glance shoots over all things and penetrates none. He occupies himself with a great deal, yet nothing occupies him. Jester and jolly fellow, he keeps on good terms with all political opinions, and is patriotic to the bottom of his soul. A capital mimic, he knows how to put on, turn and turn about, the smiles of persuasion, satisfaction, and good nature, or drop them for the normal expression of his natural man. He is compelled to be an observer of a certain sort in the interests of his trade. He must probe men with a glance and guess their habits, wants, and above all their solvency. To economize time he must come to quick decisions as to his chances of success, a practice that makes him more or less a man of judgment, on the strength of which he sets up as a judge of theaters, and discourses about those of Paris and the provinces. He knows all the good and bad haunts in France, d'actuat visu. He can pilot you, on occasion, to vice or virtue with equal assurance. Blessed with the eloquence of a hot water spigot turned on at will, he can check or let run, without floundering, the collection of phrases which he keeps on tap, and which produce upon his victims the effect of a moral shower bath. Loquacious as a cricket, he smokes, drinks, wears a profusion of trinkets, overawes the common people, passes for a lord in the villages, and never permits himself to be stumped, a slang expression all his own. He knows how to slap his pockets at the right time, and make his money jingle if he thinks the servants of the second-class houses which he wants to enter, always eminently suspicious, are likely to take him for a thief. Activity is not the least surprising quality of this human machine. Not the hawk swooping upon its prey, not the stag doubling before the huntsmen and the hounds, nor the hounds themselves catching scent of the game, can be compared with him for the rapidity of his dart when he spies a commission, for the agility with which he trips up a rival and gets ahead of him, for the keenness of his scent as he noses a customer and discovers the sport where he can get off his wares. How many great qualities must such a man possess? You will find in all countries many such diplomats of low degree, consummate negotiators arguing in the interests of calico, jewels, frippery, wines, and often displaying more true diplomacy than ambassadors themselves, who, for the most part, know only the forms of it. No one in France can doubt the powers of the commercial traveler, that intrepid soul who dares all, and boldly brings the genius of civilization and the modern inventions of Paris into a struggle with the plain common sense of remote villages, and the ignorant and boorish treadmill of provincial ways. Can we ever forget the skillful maneuvers by which he worms himself into the minds of the populace, bringing a volume of words to bear upon the refractory, reminding us of the indefatigable worker in marbles whose file eats slowly into a block of porphyry? Would you seek to know the utmost power of language, or the strongest pressure that a phrase can bring to bear against rebellious lucre, against the miserly proprietor squatting in the recesses of his country lair? Listen to one of these great ambassadors of Parisian industry as he revolves and works and sucks like an intelligent piston of the steam engine called speculation. "Monsieur," said a wise political economist, the director, cashier, manager and secretary general of a celebrated fire insurance company, "out of every 500,000 francs of policies to be renewed in the provinces, not more than 50,000 are paid up voluntarily. The other 450,000 are gutted by the activity of our agents, who go about among those who are in arrears and worry them with stories of horrible incendiaries until they are driven to sign the new policies. Thus you see that eloquence, the labial flux, is 9/10 of the ways and means of our business. To talk, to make people listen to you, that is seduction in itself. A nation that has two chambers, a woman who lends both ears, are soon lost. Even her serpent are the everlasting myth of an hourly fact which began, and may end, with the world itself. A conversation of 2 hours ought to capture your man, said a retired lawyer. Let us walk round the commercial traveler, and look at him well. Don't forget his overcoat, olive green, nor his cloak with its morocco collar, nor the striped blue cotton shirt. In this queer figure, so original that we cannot rub it out, how many diverse personalities we come across. In the first place, what an acrobat, what a circus, what a battery, all in one, is the man himself, his vocation, and his tongue. Intrepid mariner, he plunges in, armed with a few phrases, to catch 5 or 6 thousand francs in the frozen seas, in the domain of the Red Indians who inhabit the interior of France. The provincial fish will not rise to harpoons and torches, it can only be taken with seines and nets and gentlest persuasions. The traveler's business is to extract the golden country caches by a purely intellectual operation, and to extract it pleasantly and without pain. Can you think without a shudder of the flood of phrases which, day by day, renewed each dawn, leaps in cascades the length and breadth of sunny France? You know the species, let us now take a look at the individual. There lives in Paris an incomparable commercial traveler, the paragon of his race, a man who possesses in the highest degree all the qualifications necessary to the nature of his success. His speech is vitriol and likewise glue to catch and entangle his victim and make him sticky and easy to grip, vitriol to dissolve hard heads, close fists, and closer calculations. His line was once the hat, but his talents and the art with which he snared the wariest provincial had brought him such commercial celebrity that all vendors of the article Paris paid court to him, and humbly begged that he would deign to take their commissions. Article Paris means anything, especially articles of wearing apparel, which originates or is made in Paris. The name is supposed to give to the thing a special value in the provinces. Thus, when he returned to Paris in the intervals of his triumphant progress through France, he lived a life of perpetual festivity in the shape of weddings and suppers. When he was in the provinces, the correspondents in the smaller towns made much of him. In Paris, the great houses feted and caressed him. Welcomed, flattered, and fed wherever he went, it came to pass that to breakfast or to dine alone was a novelty, an event. He lived the life of a sovereign, or, better still, of a journalist. In fact, he was the perambulating feuilleton of Parisian commerce. His name was Gaudissart, and his renown, his vogue, the flatteries showered upon him, were such as to win for him the surname of illustrious. Wherever the fellow went, behind a counter or before a bar, into a salon or to the top of a stagecoach, up to a garret or to dine with a banker, everyone said, the moment they saw him, "Ah! Here comes the illustrious Gaudissart." No name was ever so in keeping with the style, the manners, the countenance, the voice, the language, of any man. All things smiled upon our traveler, and the traveler smiled back in return. Similia similibus, he believed in homeopathy. Puns, horse laugh, monkish face, skin of a friar, true Rabelaisian exterior, clothing, body, mind, and features, all pulled together to put a devil-may-care jollity into every inch of his person. Free-handed and easy-going, he might be recognized at once as the favorite of grisettes, the man who jumps lightly to the top of a stagecoach, gives a hand to the timid lady who fears to step down, jokes with the postillion about his neckerchief and contrives to sell him a cap, smiles at the maid and catches her round the waist or by the heart, gurgles at dinner like a bottle of wine and pretends to draw the cork by sounding a fillip on his distended cheek, plays a tune with his knife on the champagne glasses without breaking them, and says to the company, "Let me see you do that," chaffs the timid traveler, contradicts the knowing one, lords it over a dinner table and manages to get the titbits for himself. A strong fellow, nevertheless, he can throw aside all this nonsense and mean business when he flings away the stump of his cigar and says, with a glance at some town, "I'll go and see what those people have got in their stomachs." Say gutter, to enjoy, to make fun. Gaudriole, gay discourse, rather free. Lettré. When buckled down to his work he became the slyest and cleverest of diplomats. All things to all men, he knew how to accost a banker like a capitalist, a magistrate like a functionary, a royalist with pious and monarchical sentiments, a bourgeois as one of themselves. In short, wherever he was just what he ought to be. He left Gaudissart at the door when he went in, and picked him up when he came out. Until 1830, the illustrious Gaudissart was faithful to the article Paris. In his close relation to the caprices of humanity, the varied paths of commerce had enabled him to observe the windings of the heart of man. He had learned the secret of persuasive eloquence, the knack of loosening the tightest purse strings, the art of rousing desire in the souls of husbands, wives, children, and servants, and what is more, he knew how to satisfy it. No one had greater faculty than he for inveigling a merchant by the charms of a bargain, and disappearing at the instant when desire had reached its crisis. Full of gratitude to the hat-making trade, he always declared that it was his efforts in behalf of the exterior of the human head which had enabled him to understand its interior. He had capped and crowned so many people, he was always flinging himself at their heads, etc. His jokes about hats and heads were irrepressible, though perhaps not dazzling. Nevertheless, after August and October, 1830, he abandoned the hat trade and the article Paris, and tore himself from things mechanical and visible to mount into the higher spheres of Parisian speculation. He forsook, to use his own words, matter for mind, manufactured products for the infinitely purer elaborations of human intelligence. This requires some explanation. The general upset of 1830 brought to birth, as everybody knows, a number of old ideas which clever speculators tried to pass off in new bodies. After 1830, ideas became property. A writer, too wise to publish his writings, once remarked that more ideas are stolen than pocket handkerchiefs. Perhaps in course of time we may have an exchange for thought. In fact, even now ideas, good or bad, have their consoles, are bought up, imported, exported,